Okie doke. Asma, let's talk a little bit about your work as editor-in-chief of altmuslima.com. Tell us why you created it, some of the issues that you explore, and what are your goals for altmuslima?
Well, altmuslima comes out of a very personal experience with both gender and Islam, particularly as it intersects with my identity as an American Muslim. Growing up in America, throughout middle school even, in high school, I was very much into religion and religious studies, but I think I had a very rosy, kind of like a warm and fuzzy picture of religion, something that was without conflict, without too much inherent diversity. And when I entered into college, I began to experience some of the more intricate issues, and in particular, certain interpretations of Islam that didn't really fit well with my rather simple and rosy version of it. And what I mean by that is that there were a lot of foreign students at my school, particularly men from Middle Eastern countries, and they had their separate Muslim organization as compared to the one that American Muslim students up on campus had formed. And their version was different from ours, most clearly in their views toward women. Of course, none of these foreign students were women, so it was an all-male group. But it was also the requirements that they had for females to participate in their events, whether it be women having to speak from behind a curtain or not partake in any sort of leadership duties, whereas the MFA, which is the American Muslim version of it, had, you know, Muslim females as presidents of the club and so on. So this was like the beginning of my introduction to problematic gender interpretation within my religion. And so, needless to say, it kind of led to a lot of internal turmoil. As somebody who was quite proud of her religion, I was of shock to have to deal with this. And it got me started on this path of internal reflection that led to quite a bit of turmoil. It actually led to what I call now my gender and Islam crisis, in the sense that it really made me question at a very deep level God and Islam and my place in it. And one of the questions that kept popping up for me is that I feel so strongly about the question of gender equality and equal women's dignity, but is that just something that's a product of my environment, or is that something that God really intended for us? And in other words, how do I fit it with this religion that I love so much? And it came out of that. I ultimately came out of it by looking beyond social commentary, looking beyond what people were saying, and just thinking for a moment and just connecting with God and having this spiritual realization that God wouldn't have created me to be anything but equal and to have equal dignity, to be able to follow a path with complete freedom in reaching him. And that's what brought me out of it. And when I came out of it, I was a much stronger Muslim than I was before I had gone through this process. And so as life experiences continue to build on that realization, particularly more practical sort of real-life interactions with various male figures in my life, the one thing that kept recurring as I reflected more and more on this, is that these experiences and that previous spiritual struggle I went through had to have happened for a reason. There must have been a reason I spent so much time thinking about this and came out of it with so much clarity and strength. And that's really where Alt Muslima comes from. The actual, like, real-life predecessor to Alt Muslima was a book club that I started. Very simple idea. Just a few years ago, I started it in the tri-state area. By tri-state, I mean New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And just started to get some women together, some young girls and women, who started reading books that related to the question of gender in Islam. And one of them was Living Islam Out Loud, and the editor of that compilation of essays was Salima Abdulghafoor, and she actually came out to one of our meetings, which ended up being quite a big meeting. And as the women were reflecting on the book, some of them just really became very emotional, and there was just this absolute honesty with which they were speaking, and it occurred to me at that moment that this was a forum that so many women needed, but so few had. And so I wanted to take it to a forum that would be available to women not just across the country, but across the world. And that's why I went online. In terms of the issues that we explore, the tabs on our site lay out the multifarious nature of gender and Islam. We have a section on relationships and sexuality. We have wellness and beauty, society and politics, mosque and community. And then we have a very interesting section called Alt Voices, which is our most recent section, and it's a section that I hope to grow as we move forward from here. And what that is, if you see it, it's actually called Alt Voices, Alt Kathalga, Alt Judaica, and more. And part of this is just coming out of my work at the Beckett Fund, where I interact with other religious freedom activists from various faiths who are very strongly tied to their faith, and who many of the women there have very strong commentaries and views on gender issues within their own faith. It occurred to me that this would be a wonderful area for interfaith dialogue. My main concern with interfaith dialogue is it tends to happen at the level of abstract theology, which ultimately leads to people agreeing to disagree, but it doesn't really make any of their deep, fundamental personal connections. And it occurs to me that by having parallel discourses on gender in each of our faiths, without necessarily explicitly linking them to the other, we would find that they are parallel and there are commonalities. And that to me is more of a, provides more space for a substantive connection among people of different faiths.
Wow, that's incredible. So that sounds like one of your goals is increased interfaith dialogue around issues of gender. Do you have other goals just in terms of who you would like to read it, raising its visibility, what you would like to see happen, say, you know, 3-5 years from now?
Yeah, I think that while the online presence is important, I think that it really needs to be supported by real-life offline events. And so I'm definitely looking to do more of that. We have done a little bit of that, but I'm looking to, especially in the D.C. area, which is where I'm now based, I would like to start doing more roundtables. We're actually planning one for October 23rd on some of the trickier relationship issues that have arisen in our community. And because a lot of those issues, like many of the things that we discuss, are things that people have been feeling very deeply but have rarely ever articulated prior to, at least not in a public way, prior to Alt-Muslim launching. So I am looking to do more roundtable type events where we can have some of our writers who have really developed a bit of a following through by writing before our site to speak briefly and to open it up to have other people in the community to be able to discuss these issues. At some point, I mean, I do have this idea of taking it to more of a fiction level, and in the sense that it's almost a theatrical presentation of some of these issues. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the things that we talk about are very sensitive, and people often feel quite afraid to come out there. They feel very vulnerable in terms of discussing some of these issues, whether it be women who are over 30 and having a hard time finding a marriage partner, some people who are considered, quote-unquote, too dark, you know, subculture racism, and their difficulties in finding a marital partner. I mean, all these issues that people, you know, they feel strongly about, but they kind of don't want to speak about them in their own name, so to speak, and which I think is valid. And I think the best way to kind of bring out some of these issues are to do it through theatrical presentation, where people can take on a different persona, but express issues that are very personal to them.
Excuse me. Can you talk for a minute about the difference between private conversations, private roundtable meetings, where people can be really frank and honest and talk about some really very personal, vexing issues, and then more public conversations that go beyond the Muslim community and maybe address stereotypes that people have about Islam and women or Muslim American women. Of all the issues that you talk about, I mean, clearly on Alt-Muslima, those are public, you know, the writing and the blogging is public, so other people can see it. How do you see these issues breaking down, and what's the utility, and when is a private conversation more important, and when is it important to really have these be, you know, on the record, public conversations for everybody to partake of?
Well, I think that in some ways we straddle both, though. We straddle the line between the public and the private on Alt-Muslim. Many of the discussions are, in terms of who's writing, who's commenting, are happening among Muslims. It is available for public consumption, but the nature of the dialogue is very much a private one, speaking and referring to things within the community. And to the extent that I have provided space to it, I think that both types of issues should always be very much open for public consumption. And I think there are spaces for more very private, personal discussions that are relevant to specifically one's private life. And those issues, I think, are coming, the sorts of discussions, I think, are branching off from Alt-Muslima, in the sense that a lot of women have told me well, you know, we have these small book clubs or these small discussion groups that we joined, that we've formed in our community, in our homes, and we take some of the content. We print out articles about Muslim and we discuss them there. So in that sense, that's happening outside of my involvement. Mm-hmm. But it's something that's very much Alt-Muslim is leading to. And then in terms of the public part of it, a huge part of my creating Alt-Muslim, I mean, it definitely came from my personal struggles, but it also, in the course of that personal struggle, I also realized that the stuff I was going through wasn't just an intra-community issue. It was very much an inter-community issue in the sense that the media was definitely, and its constant portrayal of Muslim women as oppressed and subjugated, I mean, it was reinforcing and making my gender struggle even more pronounced. And it also made me think, well, a lot of the times when non-Muslims think of Islam, they think about it in stereotypes that are very much related to gender, whether it be harems or polygamy or, you know, Taliban abusing women in Afghanistan or burqas, and all these things are just strange and exotic, but ultimately all of them really come back to the question of gender in some way. And so in having this discussion, and non-Muslim readers have told me this, they just see a level of sincerity in the way that commentators respond to articles, the way that writers express their views, and what's really being shown is that it's not that simple. These are really important issues to us, and this is how we're dealing with them, and we're completely intelligent and thoughtful and sincere in the way we deal with them. And I think that diversity of viewpoint and the way that we approach the issues on Alt-Muslim has a very like fundamental role in providing nuance to issues that are otherwise thought of in black and white. And so and earlier you had asked, you know, where do I want to take Alt-Muslim?
Yeah.
But one of the things is really, what do I want to keep about Alt-Muslim and make sure it always stays there? And the way I describe it is just like this very organic process that's growing through. It's not something where, it's not in any way artificially, you know, developed or furthered or enhanced. It's very much like, here's where we're coming from. It's a very deep place within us. And I want to always maintain this level of sincerity to that discourse and make sure that whoever writes for us and whoever comes to the site comes from a place of exploring very deep issues.
You were talking about the stereotype of Islam that a lot of non-Muslims have. Correct those stereotypes. You know, so if somebody said to you, but women are oppressed, you know, they're subjugated, there's not gender equality in the faith. What, respond to that. You know, how would you set somebody straight?
Well, I think the easiest way to set it straight, short of referring them to my website, would just be to show them myself. I mean, mm-hmm. Here I am. I'm a Muslim woman. I have a completely supportive husband, an amazing relationship with him and other men in my life, and I've never been hindered. I mean, aside from the usual sort of social limitation that we all deal with, I've never had my religion in any way limit me in my success. And for a long time, I have played that role. You know, I used to wear the hijab, and I used to wear it while working as a corporate lawyer. And for a long time, I wanted to serve that role as constantly being a representation to other people that, hey, look, I can do both. I mean, at some point, I realized that I needed to stop. I needed to stop making my decisions only for the purposes of serving that role, the representative role. But I think still it holds true that to the extent that people are confused or having questions about it, I think the living examples, whether in the form of myself or other hundreds, the vast majority of Muslim women across the world and in this country particularly, disprove that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier the Beckett Fund, where you work as an attorney, and one of the issues that they care about and that you work on is religious liberty, and that's an issue clearly that you care about very much. Can you talk about religious liberty, and if it's an absolute to you, if it has limits, what happens when somebody's religious liberty bumps into human rights for women or something like that? How do you negotiate all of those complexities?
Well, I think that religious liberty, just like all human rights, is not absolute in the sense that nothing can ever limit it. I think, however, that the limits are few and they must be very strictly and well-defined. Otherwise, the limits can very much swallow up the right. And so the types of limits would be religious freedom can be limited except for issues that might affect public safety, public order, health and morals, or the fundamental rights of others. And so, but the way that these words are defined, and in some sense, they're overly broad in terms of how many countries and governments across the world might define these. For instance, in the course of my work, I have seen that the public order exception is definitely misused in several countries. The idea being that while we can't really have people articulating problematic interpretations of a religion or criticizing a religion because the people who are listening will become very much upset and will react with violence, and so in order to limit public disorder, we're going to stop the speaker from speaking in the first place. So in U.S. jurisprudence, this would be called the hostile audience rule, and is very much not allowed in our broad free speech jurisprudence in the sense that the hostile audience should never be able to limit the nonviolent speaker. And ultimately, a law in a society is more effective in limiting disorder by focusing on the violent actor as opposed to, that is, the hostile audience, the person who reacts with violence, as opposed to a nonviolent speaker. In terms of the issue broadly, I mean, it links up to my work on the question of women and women's rights very much because it specifically one of the themes that has come out of my work that I've spoken on quite a few times is the intersection of women's rights and religious liberty. That is, a woman's right to religious freedom. And this comes out in whether it be the case of religious garb, a woman's right to wear a headscarf, for instance, or a burqa, or it might come to the situation that you had alluded to earlier, which the ability to, for instance, subject oneself to Sharia arbitration or the use of Sharia law, which in many countries outside of the U.S., there's a lot of concern. There was a big debate when Sharia arbitration was being considered in Canada, for instance, that we can't really have this because it'll take away women's rights. Women will be forced against their will and will end up with fewer rights than their non-Muslim Canadians. And that I agree, and I completely acknowledge the role of voluntary acquiescence to Sharia law. And I think that's the major threshold question that needs to be addressed very carefully and can be quite complicated. But I also think that once the threshold question has been addressed, that women have complete freedom, that they do it of their own will, and if they feel that it's part of their religion to decide their matters according to the religious law, that providing them these private arbitration panels is very much a part of the religious freedom right.
Can you talk a minute about that? Just expand on that a little bit more for people who might not understand what Sharia arbitration might be. What might that look like? And is there any, give us some examples or what that might be, ways in which it might work well, ways in which it might not work well? And are there any comparables in any other faith?
Well, there's definitely comparables. I mean, the U.S. Sharia arbitration is allowed, but just like as it is allowed for Orthodox Jews who want to arbitrate under their own laws and so on, for other religious communities who have those bodies of law and want to use them to resolve their disputes. The disputes are always family law issues, most often are family law issues. So it would be something like divorce, the alimony, the terms of the divorce. And the interesting thing there is that Islamic law very much affords arguably more greater rights than civil laws do, in the sense that a Muslim woman's money is always her own, and it's not really subject to division upon divorce, whereas that wouldn't be the case with civil law. But the way what happened was that in order for, so the arbitration panel, again, assuming that the parties came to it completely voluntarily, would decide an issue, but in order for the specific award or decision to be enforced, it would then go to the civil court, who in order to enforce that would first check for procedural and substantive fairness. By procedural, I mean, was the judge fair? Was the arbitrator fair, for instance? Or was there some sort of inherent bias in the process? And then in terms of substantive fairness, was the award fair? Is it grossly unfair? And so there are these checks, these checks by the civil courts that, again, protect the parties involved. The issue is, but while this might very much apply to issues of family law, it wouldn't, for instance, allow for parties to somehow circumvent existing laws in the country we're speaking of. So in the U.S., you couldn't go against the criminal laws here and somehow decriminalize something that's criminalized here. If you couldn't legitimize, for instance, polygamy, where it is criminalized in the U.S. And so it's not really a way of circumventing that. It's really working within the broader national framework and finding a space for yourself to resolve your disputes through religious law.
Great. Thank you so much for explaining that. One of the you write an On Faith column for the Washington Post pretty frequently, and recently you talked about the problem of making Muslim Americans other, seeing the community as monolithic and seeing it as very unitary and people all, you know, thinking and believing the same thing, which really ignores the diversity of Muslim Americans and of how people interpret Islam. And then you say doing that also hides the fact that Muslims disagree among themselves over a good many issues, both religious and non-religious. Could you just talk about that a little bit more?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Alt-Muslima is a perfect example of inherent diversity among Muslims. The very creation of it suggests that there are many ways to look at things and that the community needs to talk about those different things. And so, especially when it comes to gender issues, I think that everybody has an opinion and it tends to be quite diverse and held. Each person holds it quite passionately, but it's very different from the way that other people might be approaching the issue. And so, for instance, on our site, you might see the question of the very idea of, like, wearing a headscarf and the different struggles and different questions that come up with regard to it. The question that has gotten quite a bit of attention is Muslim women marrying non-Muslim men? Something that was considered a pretty black and white issue for a long time is something now in the current climate, in American Western climate, is being questioned a little. And it's not that people are not understanding the broader religious framework and the tradition there, but it's really reinterpreting these things in the light of what we're dealing with now. And so people are arguing about it. We have debates that we feature on our site. We often post an article and then have people respond to it. It's not that we go out there and solicit these articles, but people are, well, I don't agree with this position, and I have a response to it. And so we'll specifically title these pieces A, response to, and then teach you this other side of the issue. So we definitely see a lot of that on Alt-Muslima. On a scholarly level, there's of course, a different interpretation for almost every verse in the Quran. There is different methodologies for interpreting the Quran as a whole. Some take literal approach, some take contextual, some say that each verse should be interpreted within the broader context of the Quran's social justice message. And so there's definitely that sort of diversity as well. And then the part where I mentioned that Muslims disagree on non-religious issues, again, it goes to this idea that Muslims are not these machines that are kind of programmed by their religion to think in one particular way, which is definitely the way some of the characterizations out there, the mischaracterizations, are kind of making Muslims seem. And so whether it be a question of politics or foreign policy or simply a question of taste, such as art, literature, theater, Muslims have different perspectives on these things. They have different tastes, and we're just as diverse as every other group of people out there. And so really that statement is meant to humanize Muslims and show
sure.
that we're not pre-programmed.
Speaking of that, I want to just segue to some of the real hate speech that's going on right now that I think we've seen a dangerous spike in that it's not just extremists, but it's you know, more mainstream conservative politicians like Newt Gingrich and Sarah Palin saying some pretty outrageous things. And can you talk about that a little bit in comparison to the traveling you do to other countries where you get a sense of what their health is and how religious liberty is playing out there, how people are living in a pluralistic society side by side or not? How do we stack up? How do we compare to those other countries? And are things changing for the better or worse here? What's your sense of that?
Well, I think the question of hate speech links up to what I was saying earlier about the hostile audience. I think that in a lot of other countries, the way that hate speech is thought of is often thought of as an instigator of public disorder. And so there's this overly broad, even in Europe, there are hate speech laws on the books in many European countries that seek to limit hate speech. But in doing so, of course, like, well, what constitutes hate speech? And it ends up becoming broad bans on all kinds of peaceful speech that many people might not even consider hate speech. And that's ultimately the dangers that come in trying to have and having those sorts of laws. And then in Muslim countries, of course, it's even worse in the sense that often the government is in control of free speech and religious freedom. The government takes it upon itself to define what proper Islam is going to be and to outlaw everything that doesn't fit that definition. So you see mosque sermons being monitored or pre-approved by the government in many of these Muslim countries. And, of course, what's approved and what's not often is defined in terms of what suits the government's interest. And so you see what you see happening is a politicization of Islam in these countries. And it's the process of seeking truth and seeking the spiritual process of discovering Islam and negotiating its relationship with your lived reality is very much hindered by this government intrusion of religious freedom, which my travels abroad have really kind of reinforced the importance of the work that I do with the Beckett Fund. And in terms of how America stacks up, I think I'm thoroughly convinced. I don't go out there and try to impose our model on other countries. I simply see some of the wisdom that comes out of the way that U.S. law is set up and the way our society is set up. And I like to see how to the extent to which those same concepts and principles can be implemented elsewhere in those particular cultural contexts. And I think America's doing pretty well. I think that our law is perfectly balanced between having very limited categories of speech that are restricted, but otherwise allowing for the broad protection of free speech, which essentially to me means that it's not the government really who's telling us, you know, what is right and what is wrong, but we're really left to our own selves and to our own social mechanisms to determine what is right and what is wrong, to regulate ourselves as opposed to having the government regulate our behavior, which ultimately I think is more effective in developing responsible citizenship and proper relations among citizens. And in terms of the trend, I mean, there's definitely been a rise in Islamophobic rhetoric in recent days, but, you know, kind of looking at it from a broader perspective and what other groups in American history have gone through, I'm less worried about that. I think this is just a process that everybody has to go through, that every new group to the country has to go through, and it's a process that I'm confident we'll get through and we'll get to a better place.
Is the concept of free speech, though, kind sometimes a hard sell to other countries? I know when the extremist Terry Jones was threatening to burn Qurans, in a lot of Middle Eastern countries and maybe even some countries in Europe, people thought that that meant the government approved it, that people thought that it would be illegal to do certain kinds of things like that, that his proposed actions and his speech was so extreme that it seemed to other countries that it had the official seal of approval. And to try to say and explain, no, actually you could burn a Bible in America too, that is all protected speech, to try to make that sound like a good thing. How do you sell that?
Well, it's very difficult, and I agree with you. I think especially people who are coming from a context where the government does decide these things and where the solution to problematic speech is just to ban it, their first impulse is to think, well, this should just be banned.
Right.
And so it's hard to kind of like change their way of thinking about these things and say, well, this is why it shouldn't be banned, because it leads to these other problems. And again, it has been a very difficult attempt. It's not easy. I think I spent most of my time just trying to think up ways that this could make sense in different cultural contexts, and I think that's definitely the biggest hurdle. But ultimately, I think that especially as it relates to religious speech and religious expression, I have to keep going back to this idea of religion as fundamentally a process of inquiry and of trying to, it's a path that we follow, and we have to be able to ask questions and to be able to deal with these sorts of external threats, if you want to call it, or mockery or anything that's just part and parcel of this path. And so I think the second that you begin to sort of see religion as that, as a spiritual quest, as opposed to this social identity that needs to be protected, that there needs to be walls put around it to somehow protect it as if it's fragile and it will fall apart if it's threatened this way. I think it's really a fundamental difference in the way that we view our religion and religion generally. And the second you see it as something that can deal with all these things and can only come out of it stronger, I think that you're less likely to be as afraid of these sorts of statements.
I think that's right. And I just want to go back to one thing you said when you were talking about that sort of reinforces what you just said, when you were talking about being in some Muslim-majority countries where the sermons in mosques need to be approved by the government, and that intrusion is a political intrusion. It's not that the government is made up of Islamic scholars and want religious purity. It's really politics that they care about, and that they're sort of contaminating the faith and with politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, the sorts of things that they're definitely looking for are, you know, what you call the social justice components of religion or of Islam specifically, the part where people find within their faith ability to stand up against authoritarian government. That's the part that needs to be squelched by these governments, right? And that's exactly what they do. Right. Of course, what it does is it doesn't really make it disappear. Just like any oppression, broad oppression of human rights doesn't make these things go away. What it does is just drives it underground. And so, you know, when you take social justice commentary and you take it out of a healthy public debate and drive it underground, what are you going to get other than extremist rhetoric?
Right, right. I have just one last question for you, Asma, and this is just sort of a life balance question, because you are incredibly accomplished and busy. So you're a lawyer with a demanding job, and you travel, and you're the editor-in-chief and founder of Alt Muslima. You're a wife, you're a mother, you have a 3-year-old daughter, you're a public speaker. How do you balance all of this? How do you balance work and family, time for yourself? Do you have any, you know, secrets or things to say about that?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I have to say that I'm very fortunate to have a work situation that is very sensitive and specially attuned to the needs of working parents. And so, like my other colleagues at the Becca Fund, I have the ability to be quite flexible with my schedule. But then I think that the very sort of the fact that I can balance all those things and do all those things is, again, I think a good representation to those people who say, well, there's no, you know, gender equality in Islam and so on. I'm like, well, the reason I do what I can do is because I have this incredibly supportive network. I have this incredibly supportive husband who really sort of bends over backwards to make my goals possible, to make my dreams possible. And so without these people in my life to be able to juggle things, tag team, child care with, and so on, it wouldn't be possible. And then in terms of, you know, why I do all these things and why my life is this constant like juggling act, I just feel that what I do, and I have the incredible luxury to do things that I absolutely love to do, and it comes from a very deep part of me, and I think that it just makes me much happier and a much cooler mom. And so that's why I do it.
And a great example for your daughter as well. Well, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for the good work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.